Antiwar.com, Chaos Radio 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas, and Ron Paul's Campaign for Liberty. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. Thanks for tuning into the show today. It's Anti-War Radio on Chaos 92.7 FM in Austin. Always streaming from chaosradioaustin.org and antiwar.com/radio. And all this week for the first hour in conjunction with the Chaos for Liberty. Well, sort of, kind of. The Campaign for Liberty, which I think is campaignforliberty.org. And we're also streaming live from there in-depth coverage of the financial crisis. Now, these financial crisis interviews aren't making it to antiwar.com/radio in the interview archives because they're not quite foreign policy enough. We'll see if we can change that tomorrow and the next day as we cross our fingers and hope to talk to Dr. Paul and Lou Rockwell and see if we can mix a little bit more foreign policy into the discussion. But today we are going to have Peter Schiff, who is an advisor to Ron Paul, and we're going to be talking all about the financial crisis with him. And then our second interview today is going to be a guy named Jason Krieg. He's a lawyer with the Innocence Project. I guess another that won't make the cut at antiwar.com, but all these archives will be available at scotthortonshow.com. And, you know, like Horton, here's the coup. scotthortonshow.com. I have them all there. And also, they're saving up the archives and posting them at the Campaign for Liberty website, too. So, in fact, if you go to the Campaign for Liberty website or to scotthortonshow.com, you can see where Monday I talked with Robert Murphy and Mark Thornton, and yesterday, Robert Blumen. All those guys, writers for Mises.org and LouRockwell.com. And Austrian school economists, good stuff. And I'm trying to mix it up. I don't believe that the Monday and Tuesday interviews were too redundant, obviously covering a lot of the same subject matter, but I'm trying to mix the questions up. And, of course, I don't have any money. I'm no professional investor, and I don't know about these things from the ground level like these guys do. I'm much more of an anti-war guy, but I think my semi-informed ignorance is actually a pretty good place to ask these questions from. That's the way I'm looking at it. And apparently Jeff Frazee and the guys at the Campaign for Liberty agree. We don't want just a bunch of gold experts talking to each other, right? Somebody's got to stand in for the people who don't know anything about it, and that's me. All right, good. Also, please check out my blog, thestressblog.com, if you want to hang out with any of the boys in the chat room. You just follow... I'd like to say boys and girls, but I don't think there's any girls in there. Not yet. But just follow the green writing on the front page of thestressblog.com, and you will find the instructions for how to sign up for the chat room to hang out with the boys and BS back and forth during the show and so forth. Also, please check out libertystickers.com, anti-government propaganda for the back of your truck, anti-candidate stickers, anti-war, anti-police state stickers, of course, an entire category of Ron Paul stickers, none of which say Ron Paul for President 08 anymore. There are still, I don't know, must be at least 15 or 20 different Ron Paul stickers that aren't campaign stickers, but still along those lines. Some of them my ideas, some of them passed on, but I'm really proud of Liberty Stickers. It's not my company anymore, but I sure thank Rick for buying it from me and keeping it going. You know, I was driving down the road just the other day, down the highway, and I saw a bumper sticker said, "Make quilts, not war." Well, I only made 10 of those. Those were a special custom-made gift for my mom. Well, it turns out I only made like 10 of them or something. She'd left some on at the counter at the quilting goods store, and lo and behold, there's this little pink Honda driving down Mopac with "Make Quilts, Not War" on the back. I love that, man. I love that. I saw one just the other day on the way to the Quickie Mart. Oh yeah, well, if guns kill people, I guess then pencils misspell words, right? Actually, that one I think was Rick McGinnis's idea, not mine, but still, it's a Liberty sticker, and I still love seeing them on the back of people's cars and trucks. So if for no other reason than to please my eyeballs, run to libertystickers.com and spend a lot of your rapidly depreciating money there. Why not? All right. I saw this headline in the New York Times: report seeks engagement with Muslims by diplomacy. And I thought, oh, good. And then I read it. Actually, about half of it. I don't know. Madeleine Albright, the lady who announced to the whole world that it was, quote, worth it to strangle 500,000 children to death in Iraq with America's blockade in the 1990s was, quote, worth it. The woman who told that to the whole world, that it was worth it to kill those kids who you know, other than Ayman al-Zawahiri and bin Laden and the 19 dead hijackers, is probably the next in line for responsible for the September 11th attack, for the hatred which she helped to sow throughout the world with her crass statements. And, of course, she's taken it back. She told Amy Goodman, Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, told Amy Goodman, well, I wish I hadn't have said that. Refused to back down on whether the blockade was a proper policy or not. Of course not. But so anyway, forget this stupid report about Sikh Muslims by engagement. What's important here to me is that it reminded me of this book, which I didn't finish, and so I haven't interviewed the authors of it yet. Sorry, I'm trying to get to it. Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think, based on Gallup's World Poll, the largest study of its kind. And I remember that Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit and one of Ron Paul's foreign policy advisors, recommended this book, wrote a review all about it. And I just want to read you a little bit here from the introduction. I guess I wanted to say, too, I debated on September 11th a guy who I don't think was a neoconservative. We actually talked about how the neocons were ex-commies and how he didn't really trust them because of their ex-commie background. But he basically agreed with them all about everything. Anyway, so I went on to debate him, and it turned out that Islam is the enemy, according to my debate opponent, and particularly radical Islam. Now, I don't know, or just extreme Islam. I'm not sure if, like, real conservative extremists count. If you're a real conservative extremist, does that count as radicalism? I guess Mr. Kushner might be the best guy to ask that question. But anyway, so here's some truth for you. And this is the kind of thing that apparently Americans don't get a chance to hear very often. So I figured, what the hell, I'll try to share it with you here here today on the show. Amid the rhetoric of hate and growing violence manifest in both anti-Americanism in the Muslim world and in Islamophobia in the West, discrimination against or hostility toward Islam or Muslims have massively increased. In the aftermath of 9/11, President George W. Bush emphasized that America was waging a war against terrorism, not against Islam. However, the continued acts of a terrorist minority, statements by preachers of hate, Muslim and Christian alike, anti-Muslim and anti-West talk show hosts, and political commentators have inflamed emotions and distorted views. The religion of Islam and the mainstream Muslim majority has been conflated with the beliefs and actions of an extremist minority. For example, a 2006 USA Today Gallup poll found that substantial minorities of Americans admit to harboring at least some prejudice against Muslims and favoring heightened security measures for Muslims as a way to help prevent terrorism. The same poll found 44% saying that Muslims are too extreme in their religious beliefs. Nearly one quarter of Americans, 22%, say they would not want a Muslim as a neighbor. Less than half believe U.S. Muslims are loyal to the United States. And then they ask, sort of rhetorically, well, are any of these perceptions based on reality? And, of course, they're not. Not by a long shot. And I want to see if I can get to just a couple of these statistics here in the couple of minutes before we bring Peter Schiff on the show. Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think is about the silenced majority. This book is a product of a mammoth multi-year Gallup research study. Between 2001 and 2007, Gallup conducted tens of thousands of hour-long face-to-face interviews with residents of more than 35 nations that are predominantly Muslim or have substantial Muslim populations. The sample represents residents young and old, educated and illiterate, female and male, and from urban and rural settings. With a random sampling method that Gallup used, results are statistically valid within 3 points, yeah, yeah. In totality, we surveyed a sample representing more than 90% of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims, making this the largest, most comprehensive study of contemporary Muslims ever done. Gallup's research produced a number of insights, but the most important was this. The conflict between the Muslim and Western communities is far from inevitable. It is more about policy than principles. However, until and unless decision makers listen directly to the people and gain an accurate understanding of this conflict, extremists on all sides will continue to gain ground. The study revealed far more than we could possibly cover in one book, so we chose the most significant and at times surprising conclusions to share with you. Here are some of these counterintuitive discoveries. Who speaks for the West? Muslims around the world do not see the West as monolithic. They criticize or celebrate countries based on their politics, not based on their culture or religion. Dream jobs. When asked to describe their dreams for the future, Muslims don't mention fighting in a jihad, but rather getting a better job. Radical rejection. Muslim and Americans are equally likely to reject attacks on civilians as morally unjustified. Religious moderates. Those who condone acts of terrorism are a minority and are no more likely to be religious than the rest of the population. I'm sorry, that should have been the title of this book. Those who condone acts of terrorism are a minority among Muslims and are no more likely to be religious than the rest of the population. Admiration of the West. What Muslims around the world say they most admire about the West is its technology and its democracy. The same two top responses given by Americans when asked the same question. Critique of the West. What Muslims around the world say they least admire about the West is its perceived moral decay and breakdown of traditional values. The same responses given by Americans when posed the same question. Gender justice. Muslim women want equal rights and religion in their societies. Respect. Muslims around the world say that the one thing the West can do to improve relations with their societies is to moderate their views toward Muslims and respect Islam. Clerics and constitutions. The majority of those surveyed want religious leaders to have no direct role in crafting a constitution, yet favor religious law as a source of legislation. So anyway, chapter one, who are the Muslims? Democracy versus theocracy, what makes a radical, what do women want, and then finally, clash or coexistence. Are we in an ultimate battle of civilizations, an ultimate clash between the Christian West and the Muslim East? Osama bin Laden as, you know, Joe Stalin, leader of the new Islamic Soviet that's conquering the whole galaxy, or is it maybe that America's policy in the Middle East motivates the most radical thinking people over there, religious and otherwise, to committing acts of violence the same way that radical behaviors and actions, such as, for example, the strikes on September 11th, motivate Americans to act very much the same way in a bit different circumstances. All right, just trying to do a little bit of that shoe on the other foot. You heard him, and the evidence is all there. I told you the book is called Who Speaks for Islam? It's by the Gallup poll. And the people who support, in the Muslim world, the people who support terrorism against the United States are no more likely to be religious than not. How do you like that? Maybe it's not really about religion at all.
Believe I could not believe we came a bit apart. So why doesn't a recession happen in a couple of weeks or a month or so? Well, the reason it doesn't happen in a couple of weeks, you don't have a quick boom, a quick recession almost before you can see it, is because the banking system, in order to validate the process, keeps inflating. It's not a one-shot proposition. In order to keep Chrysler and the other companies afloat, they have to continue to increase the money supply, continue to inflate. So it's allow, for example, Chrysler to buy more, finance their inventory more as prices keep going up. They then have to get more bank credit to keep the thing going. It's like staying one step ahead of, if you're a heroin addict, let's say, increasing the dosage to stay one step ahead of, retribution. One step ahead of total collapse by getting a larger dose as to keep the whole inflationary boom afloat.
Anti-War Radio on Chaos 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. Streaming live worldwide on the internet, chaosradioaustin.org, antiwar.com/radio. And for the first hour of the show all week this week, from Campaign for Liberty, Ron Paul's new site, new pressure group, policy group, and we're studying the financial crisis with experts from the Austrian School of Economics, including our first guest today, Peter Schiff, who actually is or was a economic advisor to Ron Paul, at least during the presidential campaign. He is the president of Euro-Pacific Capital, based in Connecticut. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very glad to have you here today, sir. So I think my first question for you, before we get too far into all this, is about the bill going through Congress, which is, they say, a $700 billion bailout bill. Does it look, from all your latest information, that this is a done deal? Is it worth opposing for people who are opposed to it?
Well, it's certainly worth opposing, but it's probably a done deal in one shape or form. I mean, these guys have been able to cram everything else through. It's amazing that the politicians don't look back at the repeated statements that Paulson and Bernanke have made over the years. They have been consistently wrong. They have never gotten anything right. So why people are going to trust them with this much power and this much money is beyond me. But believe me, the more money we give them, the more power we give them, the more damage they're going to do.
Okay, well, now this is going to be a bit repetitive from earlier in the week, but I want to make sure and give everybody a chance to answer what is on TV, the bottom line basic question, or the way that they put it, is that this is terrible. This is terrible. Peter Schiff, you're right. It's terrible to take all this money out of the hands of everybody in this country and give it to these banks. It is terrible. But you know what? President Bush said it. It's better than the alternative, which is
no,
a complete
it's not.
Unraveling.
It's not better than the alternative.
Okay, how's that?
The alternative is worse. Because, you know, the government is not going to solve any of these problems. They're not dealing with the problems. They're trying to cover up the symptoms. And all they're going to do is allow the basic problems in our economy to worsen. And everybody is going to suffer. And in the meantime, it's not American taxpayers. You know, we're not going to suffer as taxpayers because nobody is talking about raising anybody's taxes, right? We're going to suffer as wage earners. We're going to suffer as savers because the value of the dollar is going to plunge. You know, Paulson said today, or Bernanke said, that what he's doing is not going to create any inflation. That's a bald-faced lie. It's pure inflation. We're paying for it with inflation. We're printing money to buy up all these mortgages. And it's not going to stop with $700 billion. It's going to end up into the trillions because it's not just mortgages they're buying. They're buying credit card debt. They're buying auto loans. They're buying student loans. Who knows? Eventually they might start buying up houses. There's no end in sight, and they're going to keep on creating money. And the way we're going to suffer is when people go to cash their paychecks, they're not going to buy very much. You know, Bernanke is saying if we don't do this, the banks might fail, that people might lose money that they have in the bank. Well, maybe this guarantees that the banks won't fail, but it guarantees that the money you have in your account isn't going to buy you anything. You know, I don't see how that's an improvement.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people think inflation, if people think inflation solves economic problems, They should take a trip over to Zimbabwe and ask the people over there how well inflation is working out for them.
You know, it's funny that you bring up Zimbabwe. I think if you asked anyone in the whole world, why do they have such inflation in Zimbabwe, they'll tell you the obvious answer. Because they have their money machine on full blast. They're just counterfeiting money. And yet, even as you just phrased Bernanke's lie that creating this money might cause inflation, creating the money is inflation.
Yeah, now the reason that we can get away with it and Zimbabwe can't is we got the Chinese and the Saudis and the Japanese willing to lend us the money. They don't lend any money to Zimbabwe. But one of these days the world's going to wake up and they're not going to lend us any more money. And then that's where it really hits the fan.
Well, why do they continue to buy American debt? Why is it in their interest, at least up until this point?
It's not in their interest. It's foolish. I mean, a lot of people make foolish investments. You know, many of us have probably made the mistake of throwing good money after bad. You refuse to admit your mistake. Look what Bank of America did. You know, first they invested $2 billion in Countrywide, and then when the stock collapsed, they bought the whole company because they didn't want to admit their mistake. They tried to average down, you know. So I think, you know, the rest of the world is looking at all these dollars that they've been holding on to, and they don't want to admit that they're worthless, so they keep buying our debt so they can pretend that the dollars they already own still have value. But at some point, you know, they're going to have to be confronted with this reality, because the more money we lend them, the more money they're going to lose, because we can't pay it back. All we could do is print more, because in order to pay it back, we have to export stuff to the Chinese. Well, what do we make that the Chinese want? You know, every day, more people lose their jobs in manufacturing. And you know, I do a lot of radio. I was on radio in Norway this morning. I was on television in China last night. I was in Australia. And you know, I'm telling the world to stop lending us money, and people think, well, gee, you know, isn't this unpatriotic? It's not. We're addicted to cheap money. We're addicted to borrowed money. And the more money the world loans us, the more screwed up our economy is going to get. I mean, they're pushing this credit on us. Ultimately, it's going to backfire. Eventually, the world's going to stop lending us money. I'd rather it happen sooner, because the longer it takes, the bigger the hole we're going to dig for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard people talk before about some kind of breaking point, and no one can really pinpoint, you know, when it might happen, but that basically one day it's almost inevitable that central bankers around the world are going to say to themselves, oh no, today's the day, and they're going to dump as many American securities as they possibly can before it's too late, and that's the day that the real crisis starts.
Yeah, I mean, eventually that's going to happen. I mean, one of these days the world's going to wake up, and this is going to happen. You know, I mean, there's only a question of time. You know, they're not going to be this foolish forever. But the problem is, you know, as long as the world will lend us money, we'll keep borrowing it, and we'll keep doing all the wrong things. And the world is enabling it. I mean, maybe if the world said no more, and all of a sudden interest rates started to skyrocket and the dollar started to plunge, maybe the politicians would finally see the light and would make the needed reforms. But instead, by the world continuously lending us money, they allow the politicians to take the cheap way out, to try to, you know, appease all the electorate and to pretend that there's a solution that doesn't involve sacrifice. And there's not. I mean, there's no way that we can go from this borrow and spend economy, which is unsustainable, which is the source of our problems. And of course, that the root of that is our cheap money, or the Federal Reserve and government. But we can't go from that to a sound economy that's based on underconsumption, on savings and production. We can't get from where we are to where we need to be without a severe recession, without a lot of people losing money. We, you know, assets have to fall in price. Homes have to go down in price. They're too expensive. Americans have to be confronted with the reality that they haven't saved enough and they can't retire. And we're going to have to start working and doing real work, making stuff. We just can't pretend to go to work in the service sector. We just all can't work in the legal profession or for government or in healthcare. We've actually got to make stuff. If we want to consume, we've got to produce.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you mentioned that it's going to be trillions. Don't believe them for a second when they say $700 billion. How many trillions do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, at least a couple. I mean, maybe more by the time it's all over. I mean, the government never estimates the cost of anything right, whether any kind of program. And everything they do, they screw up. I mean, how are they going to run this? This is going to be the biggest, you know, this is going to be hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars. It's going to be run out of Washington. Washington, I mean, they can't even deliver the mail. You know, how are they going to run, you know, this biggest, investment fund in the world, ultimately? How are they going to be able to do it? And what, they're going to hire the same Wall Street idiots that got, you know, that bankrupted their own firms? They're going to do a better job? This is going to be a political boondoggle. And then, of course, once the government owns all these mortgages, are they going to foreclose when people don't pay? No, who knows? They might end up saying, okay, you know, nobody has, you know, ban foreclosures. And the minute they do that, nobody's going to pay their mortgage. I mean, they're going to buy up this paper, and then it's going to, they're going to devalue it the minute they buy it. I mean, it's going to, look, this is going to be a boondoggle. There's going to be all kinds of patronage, all kinds of people trying to get jobs, running this money, managing this money, and it's going to be done for political reasons, not for economic reasons. I mean, and every time we do one of these bailouts, you'll notice it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and government is growing with each step that it takes. And the crazy part about it is, all of these problems are the result of government interference in the free market. It's the result of the Fed and our being on a fiat money where the Fed was able to take interest rates and set them at a rate much too low given our low rate of savings and all the borrowing. So they created all the malinvestments. They encouraged all the reckless borrowing and spending. And then you have big government creations like Fannie and Freddie that were guaranteeing mortgages, taking all the risk out of the mortgage lending. I mean, without Fannie and Freddie, people wouldn't have been able to borrow all this money to buy homes because nobody would have loaned it to them on those crazy terms. It was only because the government stepped in and invalidated the free market. The free market would have guarded against this because lenders would have been concerned about losing money. But once the government stepped up and said, don't worry about losing money because we're gonna cover you, they created it. So the government creates this gigantic mess. And now they use the disaster as an excuse to get even bigger and to get even more power because they're blaming this collapse on capitalism. They're blaming it on a lack of regulation when it's actually the opposite was the cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have this term called deregulation, which means that maybe 5 out of 700 billion rules have been repealed that maybe allow a little bit more fraud than under the rules before, but that's not really deregulation when we all have to still bail them out, is it?
No. I mean, and if we go back to the free market, then, you know, the problems will eventually be solved, but the government doesn't like the manner in which they get solved. You know, as I said, if you're a heroin addict and you want to get healthy, the problem is you got to go through withdrawal first. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you're going to be a healthier person if you can get the heroin out of your body. But you can't do it without withdrawal. We're addicted to spending and money, borrowing and spending. We got this cheap money. We got to get it out of our system. But it means that we can't, you know, buy everything when we want. We can't buy new cars. We can't buy all the new gadgets and all the new big screen TVs. And, you know, we can't remodel our houses and do all this stuff because we don't have the money. And we can't keep borrowing it because how can we pay it back?
Right. All right. Now, when we go back over the last few weeks, and I guess, you know, beginning in the spring, you had the Bear Stearns and all that kind of stuff, but you have Merrill Lynch and AIG. One of the things I heard about the AIG bailout was that the government now has an 80% ownership stake in AIG. Is that correct? And then how long is that expected to last?
Well, 80%. Ownership, and they loaned AIG $85 billion. So first they're on the hook for $85 billion, and I think they got 80% of the common stock, and now they're running a company. They're running the world's biggest insurance company. I mean, this is what right do they have to do this? I mean, what constitutional authority do they have, number one, to go in there? And the scary thing about it is if the government could just go in there and buy out a sick company, right, which is what they did. I mean, this is not – who they could buy any company. They could buy a healthy company. I mean, we've stated the precedent now. It's like we don't even need to have a communist revolution. If the government wants to take over the property, now they have the formula. The Fed just prints up the money and starts buying everything.
Well, that's funny because, you know, I think a central bank is like plink 3 or 4 of the Communist Manifesto. But
see, there's no limit to how much money they can print.
Right.
And if you say the Federal Reserve can start buying assets by printing money, they can buy up the whole country. Who's going to stop them?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and bankrupt every other property owner who's trying to save in the process by the inflation.
And ultimately, they think, well, the government is buying the assets. They're not buying them. They're seizing them because ultimately the money that people are getting in exchange for the property is not going to have any value.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so is it expected that they're going to continue to own AIG 80% from now on, or they're going to
only... I don't know what they expect. Who knows? I mean, who knows what they're doing? But these guys are clueless. Again, these are politicians. What do they know about running this insurance company? These guys don't know anything. And who knows what other assets they're going to be buying that they have no idea what they are?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I just wondered whether they're even saying that they plan on selling those shares again once everything's fine.
They're just grabbing straws. I mean, this whole phony economy is about to come tumbling down, and all they care about is how can I get reelected, and what can we do to slow this down? Mm-hmm. And they don't care how much worse they made it. I mean, I was, you know, screaming this stuff 4 or 5 years ago because I saw what we were doing to try to postpone or try to avoid the recession or soften the recession that we should have had back in 2001, 2002 when the NASDAQ bubble blew up, which was another creation of government. But, you know, the politicians didn't allow that recession to run its course. And in order to spare us that recession, they laid the foundation and created the housing bubble. They're the ones that enabled us to borrow these trillions of dollars, and all this failure, all this stuff that's happening now is a direct result of government intervention a few years ago. What's going to be the result of this intervention, which is much bigger, much grander than what they did back then? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always consequences to what the government does. They don't solve a problem. They just create a bigger problem every time they act.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I think it's kind of hard to tell from where I'm sitting. I wonder if you have any kind of clarity on how big of a revolution within the form are we experiencing here. I mean, is this equal to a brand new deal, or it's a tenth of one, or two of them?
Look, I think some kind of brand new deal is coming, you know, in the next administration. I mean, after we've bailed out Wall Street, no one is going to be able to say no to the bailouts for Main Street. And so it's going to be probably bigger than the New Deal. The problem is we can't even afford the old deal, let alone this new one.
Right.
And back in 1930s, when, you know, Roosevelt enacted the New Deal, America had savings. We were still able to pay for it. As misguided as the New Deal was, at least we can afford it. We can't afford anything now. We are flat broke. And that's the risk. The real risk is that, you know, we underestimate this, and that the rest of the world doesn't want to loan us any money, and our dollar collapses, the currency collapses, and we have hyperinflation. And that's when you potentially have civil unrest and riots and looting. And I mean, there's some really bad things that are going to happen if we continue on this course. That's why, you know, I'm so, you know, I work at Euro-Pacific Capital, and that's why I am so feverishly trying to help my clients and anybody who will listen to me get rid of their dollars. I mean, I see where this is going. You know, as I said, it's not the taxpayers who are going to suffer. It's anyone who has U.S. currency. It's anyone who collects wages in U.S. dollars. Now, I can't do anything about your wages. But if you have savings, if you've got money in bonds and a CD or muni bonds, money market, if you have U.S. assets, I can help you get rid of those dollars before the dollar loses its value. And you got to get your money into foreign currencies. You got to invest abroad. You got to buy precious metals. You know, anything but U.S. currency. Because if you're holding U.S. dollars, you're going to be stuck with this massive bill. And it's all going to hit you in the form of depreciation of your currency, which means every time you want to buy something, it's going to be that much more expensive.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the key phrases for people who aren't so immersed in this subject, but one of the ways to get them to understand, I think, immediately is something that you're just describing, which is inflation as a hidden tax, basically. Like you said before, they're not going to raise taxes, but you're going to pay because it's sort of like they're kind of reaching into your pocket and picking the corners off your dollars in your pocket and stealing the value out of your dollars. The same reason it's a crime for me to counterfeit in my basement, right?
Hey, well, exactly. I mean, although the government, you know, the government outlaws counterfeiting because they hate competition. I mean, they're running the biggest counterfeit organization in the world because all of our money is counterfeit. It's supposed to be backed by gold. Instead, it's backed by nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I'm glad you said that because I wanted to ask you about what's a better way, and I'm sure that in your view it has something to do with gold, but I want to start off with the common perception that, oh, you're one of those gold people and that's some kind of weird, outdated thing. After all,
it's not weird or outdated at all because gold is money. The people who oppose gold don't understand what money is. In fact, the reason, the basic reason that this economy is so sick is because of the bad money. I mean, gold is maybe to an economy like blood is to the human body. And if you've got, you know, got toxic or tainted blood going through your body, you're not going to live. And that's why we're dying, because the money is no good. Money needs to have intrinsic value. I mean, it needs to be something real. I mean, what's the difference between a $1 bill and a $100 bill? You know, nothing. It's just a couple of extra zeros. There's no difference. But if you have 100 ounces of gold and you have 1 ounce of gold, there's a big difference there. There's 100 more ounces. You know, it takes a lot of extra effort. It takes 100 times the effort to mine 100 ounces as it does to mine 1 ounce. I mean, why do you think a quarter is bigger than a dime? Because there's more metal there. I mean, real money has actual value. And we were on a gold standard. Remember, for the first 200 years of this country, up until 1971, the dollar was tied to gold. So it's only since 1971 But we've been off the gold standard. So saying I want to go back to a gold standard isn't like I'm going back to the Stone Age. We're going back to the 1960s. But the thing was, the entire world was on a gold standard. And what happened is after the Second World War, we basically convinced the world to go off a gold standard and adopt a dollar standard because the dollar was backed by gold. And we told everybody, look, hold dollars as the reserve. You can earn interest. And we've got all the gold here in Fort Knox. And if you need any gold, you can, for every 30, you know, 35 ounce dollars that you have, we'll give you an ounce of gold. And so the world stayed on that dollar standard, but was still a gold standard up until 1971 when we repudiated because we just printed too much money. We abused that privilege. We basically conned the world, and then we declared bankruptcy because we wouldn't redeem our notes. And then the dollar lost about two-thirds of its value in the ensuing 6 years, but it stayed as the reserve currency even though it was no longer backed by anything. It was the reserve currency at a lower value because it no longer had the gold backing, but it stayed the reserve currency. And ultimately, I think it's going to lose that status because it can't be the reserve currency. We can't have a reserve currency that has no value if we keep printing it. I mean, initially, the value of the dollar was American exports and American assets that people wanted to buy. But, you know, we're not exporting anymore, at least like we used to. And our assets, who wants our assets? So the dollar is going to collapse, and ultimately we have to go back to real money. But politicians hate gold because it imposes discipline on them. See, if we were on the gold standard right now, this plan wouldn't even be up for debate. I mean, obviously, we wouldn't even have had a housing bubble. We wouldn't have had a stock market bubble, so there would be no need for the rescue because there'd be nothing to rescue. But under a gold standard, if politicians want to spend money, they have to have the gold. They just can't print it. So that's why politicians don't like the gold standard. You know, because it keeps them honest. I mean, just like if you go out on a date, if a high school kid goes on a date, he doesn't want a chaperone there. You know, they don't want chaperones at the party, but they're there anyway. And so gold is like a chaperone, making sure that the politicians are honest. And that's why they don't want gold around.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've read some analyses before that said that Kissinger, in a way, worked out what amounted to sort of a pseudo-oil standard after being taken off the gold standard, and that because we have an agreement with the Saudis to denominate their oil sales in dollars, that helps to prop up the dollar as the reserve currency. And of course, there are some who say
it does. I mean, it gives the dollar some value but of course, the Saudis keep raising the price of oil. It's not like they fix the price of oil to the dollar. So as the dollar loses value, the Saudis continue to raise the price. So you don't get to restore any value. If the Saudis said, we're going to fix oil in dollars and you're going to have a known quantity of oil for your dollars, then it would be some kind of backing. But as long as the Saudis are free to raise their prices, you know, then it really doesn't amount to much of a backing.
I see. And do you put any stock in the idea that that was part of the motivation for the war in Iraq and possibly for one coming up with Iran, that they were trying to switch to denominate their oil sales in euros?
Yeah, I mean, I hear that. I mean, that Iran and other countries are moving away from the dollar, and that might have been a reason we went in there. And who knows? It might have been. I mean, I don't know. We can speculate. I know the one reason we didn't go in there was weapons of mass destruction. I mean, obviously, you know, they weren't there, and I'm sure that they knew they weren't there. I don't think that they actually believed they were there. I mean, our intelligence has got to be good enough to know that they weren't there. And it's like the same guys that told us we had to go into Iraq, right? We had to. We had no choice. There was weapons of mass destruction there. We had to go in. These are the same guys that are saying we have to pass this plan or the whole economy is going to collapse. We have to pass this plan. We have no choice. Of course we have a choice. And you know what? If the economy was about to collapse, there's no way that this plan would save it. Now, that's the crazy part. You've got the government saying that the fundamentals of the economy are sound, that everything is sound. Yet, on the other hand, they say if we don't pass this bailout bill, the entire country is going to collapse, and it's going to be Armageddon and worse than the Great Depression. Well, which is it? Are we teetering on the edge of depression, or is the economy sound? I mean, it can't be both.
Right. Okay.
You know, and if the economy was really sound, then it wouldn't need a bailout. Sounded, you know. And in fact, the reason that all these problems are happening is because the economy is not sound. That's what they don't understand.
Well, now, if Ron had won the nomination and you were in line to be, I don't know, Treasury Secretary or the next chairman of the Fed or something, obviously the media would be asking you all day, every day, what the plan is.
I would just close it down, and that would be the end of my job.
Well, that would be nice. Okay, how about he appoints you Treasury Secretary? Now you're in the fight of your life versus the Barack Obama team for who's going to be the president. What's your proposal? How do we fix this other than just saying, well, abolish the SEC? I mean, specifically, how should
remember,
we have it set from
no
now
way
on?
To fix. There's no fix that automatically, there's nothing the government can do to solve the problem so that people don't suffer. Because that's impossible. All right, there's no way to do that. We're going to have to pay the price for all this reckless borrowing and spending. We've gutted our economy. We've blown through our savings. We've destroyed our manufacturing base. We've allowed our infrastructure to decay. So we are going to have to suffer a rather substantial decline in our standard of living. I mean, that's the bad news. There's no way around that. The good news is if we can have some meaningful reforms on the federal level, if we can bring the government back to size, if we can restore sound money, one of these days, we're going to dig our way out of this hole. But if we don't do that, we're never going to get out of it. We're just going to keep digging ourselves deeper. So what I would try to do is try to, spearhead a movement to, A, restore sound money, to get back on a gold standard somehow, to maybe try to restructure our national debt and to work with the lenders around the world at a meaningful way to not just default, but maybe renegotiate the terms. Because basically we can level with our creditors and say, look, you are going to get inflated away and you are going to get nothing. Why don't you agree to a lower amount now, but at least we'll pay you back in real money? We can try to do that. We can try to abolish all the entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare and maybe try to find a way to have some kind of temporary transition for people who really need some help. But if we don't do that, if we don't abolish Social Security, the Social Security payments are going to be worthless. And it's not going to matter that the checks come in the mail because they're not going to buy anything. You know, we need to abolish these taxes like the income tax and the payroll tax and the corporate income tax. We need to slash government. We need to make government small. We got to get rid of entire departments. You know, and if we can do all that, then we can rebuild the economy because we won't have the government, on our backs. You know, how can we dig our way out of this hole if the government is stepping on all the shovels?
Now, when you say gold standard, do you mean that there should be no fractional reserve banking at all?
No. You can still have fractional reserve banking. What I'm saying is money has to be backed by something. It can't be backed by nothing. It doesn't. It has to have some intrinsic value. And there has to be some limit on the ability of government to just create it out of thin air. So you have to have something behind it. It can't just be nothing. It can't be political hot air that backs your money. Because money has to have value. I mean, the reason that we have money as opposed to barter is because we're all basically bartering for money. But money itself has to have some intrinsic value. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Not for long anyway, it looks like.
Well, otherwise, you're just basing your money on faith in politicians. And they've proven time and time again that they can't be trusted.
Well, now anything
I'd rather trust gold instead of the politician.
Well, but now anything less than 100% gold standard is money out of nothing too, right?
No. Once you have some kind of fixed backing and you have this is, each ounce of gold, each dollar is worth, this much of gold. There is the discipline right there because you can't print more money unless you mine gold. There's something, look, it should be backed at some level, but of course, obviously we can't do it with gold at $800 an ounce. Maybe gold will have to be valued at, $5,000 an ounce. I don't know where it's going to have to be valued, but it doesn't matter. We have to figure out what price we can set it at where we can back the money and then go from there.
Mm-hmm. All right, now this is way off topic. As far as I've read, I haven't seen that you've addressed this or anything, but I figure I'll take a shot in the dark on it. Are you familiar with the reporter Greg Palast?
No.
Kind of a liberal. The story with him is that he, I guess, kind of undercover working with this labor union somehow. He went and studied under Art Laffer and all the Chicago School economists and things like that. And so he's got a real economist understanding, although he does come from more of a left-wing perspective. But in his book, Our Madhouse, he describes a lot of this stock market bubble, I think, as, somewhat, and I don't know exactly, personalities or what. I don't think he points to the finger that specifically. But I think he's basically trying to say that they created this bubble so that all of us regular people would put all our money in the stock market and inflate the values way up. Then all the most rich and powerful people take all their money out because they've already given up on America. They think America's done for. They're going to take their money out and move it to China.
I don't think they're smart enough to pull everything off. I think it's just the not natural consequences of the inept policies and the inflation to take credit. But if you think, you know, Art Laffer, I mean, if you want to see a funny debate with me and Art Laffer that took place on Kudlow and Company a couple of years ago, if you just go on, you know, on YouTube and type in Kudlow, you know, one of the top four or five watched shows is, you know, see a picture of me there, but it's a date with me and Art Laffer. You can see how completely off base Art Laffer was, just a, you know, a year before this crisis happened, talking about how great everything was when I tried to warn him. I mean, you know, just watch it. I want to, you know, and also if you want to see a really good video on YouTube, there's eight of them up there of me. If you type in Peter Schiff Mortgage Bankers, you can see these eight clips that'll come up of a presentation I made in 2006 in front of the Western Regional Association of Mortgage Bankers, and I totally laid out exactly what was going to happen in the mortgage market and the housing market to a stunned audience of about 2,000 people who were in the mortgage lending business. And you can, you know, it's just an amazing. And if people think that this stuff happened out of left field, you know, the politicians are pretending that they could, nobody could have predicted this. Well, it was easily predictable if you understood economics. If you understood money, you knew exactly what was going to happen. And the problem is the people who didn't understand it, who were completely blindsided, those are the people who are now being asked to fix the problem that they inadvertently created, and they have no understanding of how, why. And all they're going to do is make it worse.
Well, let me ask you in a more general sense, would it even be fair to say, assuming I characterized his argument correctly at all in the first place, would it be fair to say that that's even true kind of in effect, that the people who are the richest are, you know, smart enough to get out before the big collapse comes, and that they're moving all their investments to China and leaving all the regular working people in this country holding back?
I don't know what the average, you know, what these richest people are doing. I know what my clients are doing and what I'm encouraging people to do and get out of the dollar. And, you know, whether these guys are smart enough to be doing that with their own money, I don't know. You know, I have no clue what they're doing with their own money. But if they were smart, they would be doing exactly what I'm doing with my money and exactly what I'm encouraging my clients to do. That's get out of the currency that's being debased. Get out of the dollar and own foreign assets, own foreign stocks, foreign bonds, own precious metals, own pretty much anything but U.S. dollars or dollar-denominated debt.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now the other thing, I mean, what you really focused on there with your first answer was the ignorance of the people who've created this mess. And this is something that I hear Ron Paul talk about when they interview him on TV about this crisis, is that the people on Capitol Hill, for one group, have no idea. That they don't listen to him, they don't understand, they refuse, just like Bill Clinton on The Daily Show last night, they refuse to rewind any further than, well, there were too many mortgages, like that was the big bang and nothing ever preceded it. And, wow, is it really that bad that the people who run America's economic system from D.C. really don't understand the basic premises of creating a bunch of money in a big bubble and then the bubble pops and you have to deal with it? They just can't even understand this at all?
Yeah, I mean, they're crazy.
It really
yeah,
is not
I don't
bad.
Know. I mean, they're just completely, they don't understand what's going on, and they have a distorted view of reality. They've been living in this bubble in Washington, D.C. for so long. They believe that, you know, this economy is infallible, that everything that we do is great. And, you know, and it's not the case anymore. You know, we're not the country that they remember. And they don't understand to the extent to which we're living off the charity of the rest of the world. And the thing is, the world doesn't realize that they're being charitable. They think they're investing in a viable economy when they're not. They're helping to sustain a bubble. And eventually this thing is going to burst around them, and they're not going to understand what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, another thing that Bill Clinton said last night on The Daily Show is that he's for the bailout, but we got to put all our strings attached. Like you said at the beginning, all the politicians can say is that they're, apparently we had a free market last month, and what we need now is real regulations. And he said that one of his conditions that he would insist on would be a freeze on foreclosures. Now, and that sounds pretty good, I think, maybe to somebody who doesn't really understand. Here are these people are going to lose their house even though they've been paying all this money. Tell us why that, you know, what kind of consequences
the minute you freeze foreclosures, people are going to stop making their mortgage payments. Even the people who are making them now, the minute they know that they can't get foreclosed on, then why make your mortgage payment? Why not live rent-free? And so there's the moral hazard there. When you freeze foreclosures, you end up with a lot more people who don't make their mortgage payments. So you make the problem bigger, and you immediately debase the value of all this paper the government is scooping up. But, you know, what the government is trying to do is artificially keep home prices high by keeping these foreclosures off the market. But why? Why are they trying to fix prices? Real estate prices need to go down. I mean, actually, wouldn't that benefit people if houses were a lot cheaper, if housing was more affordable, if we didn't have to hock our souls to the devil to buy a house, if we didn't have to borrow so much money that people can actually afford houses? Why does the government feel that they have to keep housing expensive? You know, just let home prices fall, because they're way too high. And that's going to have to happen, but the government is going to come in here and create all these problems. And people who are living in houses that are, you know, they're not going to get hurt if they get foreclosed. I mean, it's not like they're going to be out on the street. You know, I read an article about a guy who walked away from his mortgage. He wasn't even foreclosed on up in California. His mortgage payment was $3,400 a month. He decided he didn't want to pay it anymore, so he walked away. And he rented a brand new house in the same neighborhood, five bedrooms instead of four, nicer, newer house, with the rent is $1,200 a month. So how was that guy hurt? Because he got out from under a $3,400 mortgage that he never should have taken on in the first place, that he never would have had if it wasn't for the government inflating real estate prices, and now he's renting a nicer house for a third of the cost without the headaches. Mm-hmm. Now he doesn't have to pay the maintenance anymore. He doesn't have to worry about what happens if the roof leaks, because he just calls the landlord now. So, I mean, this is all saying that we're helping these homeowners. It's not helping homeowners. It doesn't matter. You know, most of these people put very little down in the house anyway. What difference does it make? And a lot of people have already extracted and spent the equity. You know, they're trying to help the creditors. They're trying to help the people who loaned them the money. But ultimately, even those people are going to be hurt, because they're not going to get paid back in anything real. I mean, it'd be better if you loan somebody money to buy a house and you foreclose and you get back 30 or 40 cents on the dollar than have the government let you get all your money back, but inflation is so rampant that you get all your money back, but you have a 90% decline in its buying power.
You know, I have a friend who called me up and said, and he had bought a house, I guess, a couple of years ago, and he said he ran into a little bit of financial trouble, but he's a real money-making guy, and he was obviously going to be able to get out of it real quick. But he said he felt just a little bit behind, and rather than trying to work out any sort of deal where he would be able to pay them back, and I know for a fact it only took him a couple of weeks anyway, but he said that he got the idea that they were trying really hard to just get him to give up and to go ahead and foreclose on him rather than continue collecting the money that he owed him. Why is that, you think?
Why is what again?
Why was it? His impression was that the bank preferred that he default and that they could foreclose on him rather than continue collecting his payments.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on the situation as far as, you know, what he could actually pay. I mean, if they thought they could sell it to somebody who could actually afford it, I mean, what's the point of just delaying the inevitable? I mean, a lot of the problem is you keep the homeowner in the home and you know that they ultimately can't afford it. Meanwhile, the longer he's in that home, the less the home is worth. And so for a lot of the banks, it actually would be better to take the home and sell it now before it loses any more value. Mm. And at least let somebody buy it who's actually going to put up some money. You know, if you've got no equity, see, once you have no equity in a property, you have no incentive to even take care of it. You have no incentive to maintain it. And that's the problem. You have a lot of people who are living in homes right now with no incentive to maintain them. And they're going to run them into the ground. That's why a lot of these homes, when they get foreclosed on and you take a look at them, they've actually been gutted. They've been deliberately destroyed. People rip out the plumbing and, you know, and sell it for the copper. Because what do they care what they do to the house? They don't have no equity in it. So having a bunch of people in homes with no equity is very dangerous for the lenders.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, somebody sent me an email, and this is our last question here. Peter Schiff, president of Euro-Pacific Capital, economic advisor to Dr. Ron Paul. I got an article this morning that said, oh, this is just the beginning. As you said, you know, we've probably got trillions coming down the line here. And this article was focusing on what they call credit default swaps, which they said was this new mechanism where banks committed even more fraud and got themselves in even deeper trouble than before. Can you explain to us what these things are and what the big deal is?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, this is going to be another derivative disaster waiting to happen. But basically, what a credit default swap is if I buy a risky asset like a subprime mortgage, or if I have a transaction where a counterparty is a bank or an investment bank that might go under, I want to protect myself in case that entity goes broke, right? And they're not going to perform to their contract. So Wall Street created these credit default swaps where you can buy insurance on whether or not the entity, you know, so that if the entity goes bankrupt, the insurance will pay off. And of course, when you buy it, you hope that, you know, it doesn't, you know, that you don't need it. Just like when somebody buys fire insurance, they don't hope the house burns down. They hope they don't need to cash in on the policy. But of course, once these vehicles started to exist, you have a lot of people that start speculating and trading in them. And they do it with tremendous leverage, and it really starts to expose the problems, because all of a sudden some of the companies that are in trouble, the credit default swaps, you know, go up, and it costs people, it's more expensive to hedge, and then they don't want to deal with those firms. But the real problem is when all these firms start to fail, and the counterparties on the other side of the credit default swaps, they don't have the money. It's like, let's assume you're writing fire insurance policies, and you just assume that none of the houses are going to burn down. And you take all the insurance money that everybody gives you for their premiums, and you just spend it, right? All of a sudden, there's a huge wildfire, and every single house you insure burns down. Well, I mean, you're done. I mean, you couldn't even, you know, and this is what's happening. All of a sudden, it overwhelms it, and now all of a sudden, a lot of people that bought these credit default swaps, they thought they had protection, and it turns out they don't have protection because the insurance company that sold them the swap went broke. Because they had too many people trying to redeem them at once.
It's like,
there's all these, we've been living on borrowed money, on gimmicks, and it's all because it's this giant credit bubble. And it was destined to collapse, and that's what's happening right now. And you've got all these politicians trying to desperately reflate it and blow more air into it, but it never works.
It's funny, it's almost like our entire economic system is based on the model of one of those kind of marginal vitamin sale distributorship things.
Yeah, or a giant Ponzi scheme. And that's why when I wrote the book Crash Proof, you know, I was on the cover of the book, Inside the Flap, I referred to our economy as a house of cards. I said it was impressive on the outside, but a disaster waiting to happen beneath the surface. And this is what's happening. You know, it's almost like, you know, termites can eat a house all the way to the paint. And you can look at the house and you can think that the house is solid, but all of a sudden, you know, one big wind and it's going to topple it.
Yep.
And that was the situation with our economy.
All right, everybody, that's Peter Schiff. He's president of Euro-Pacific Capital and advisor to Dr. Ron Paul. I thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, you know, people should also get, if you want to try to convince people or help, you know, to Ron Paul's ideas, I mean, people are trying to pretend that all this was unpredictable. If you get people to read that book, Crash Proof, let them read it. Let them read the chapter on real estate, on money, and on inflation and all this. I mean, it was all predictable. None of this is coming out of left field, and it's all caused by government. So I would try to get that book, and I have another book that's actually coming out in about 2 weeks called A Little Book of Bull Moves and Bear Markets. But Crash Proof is available now, and I think the more copies we can get out there, we can educate people so they understand the real cause of these problems and that more government is not the solution. It's just going to create even bigger problems.
Great. And is there a website you'd like to refer people to look
at?
Yeah,
people can go to my website at www.europac.net. In fact, I do my own radio show every Wednesday. You can listen on that site and on shortwave radio. And I've got hundreds of video interviews going back for years and commentaries with me debating all sorts of people. And, I mean, they were all wrong. Everything that all the other experts have said, they're still wrong, yet people keep going back to them and asking them for their advice. You know, it's like the definition of insanity is repeating the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Mm-hmm.
Yet everybody goes back to these same experts who have been repeatedly wrong and expects them to all of a sudden be right.
Yep. Well, same story, different day in America. All right, thanks very much for your time today, Peter.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, folks, that's Peter Schiff. He's president of Euro-Pacific Capital in Connecticut, advisor to Ron Paul. Again, the book Crash Proof. And, you know, at chaosradioaustin.org, we're having some server problems. Something's going on with the live stream, and so I hope it's okay. I'm going to go ahead and leave up my connection to Ron Paul's campaign for liberty and hope that people can still listen from there since we're having a problem with the Chaos Radio Austin stream, and that's the very same stream linked at antiwar.com/radio. So I hope that's okay with Jeff Frazee and the boys at the Campaign for Liberty. I'm going to play y'all a tune, come back, do a little bit of news, and then we're going to be talking with Jason Krieg from the Innocence Project. It's Antiwar Radio on Chaos Radio Austin 92.7.
Yeah.
There's some Brutality Inc. for you on Chaos Radio 92.7. And let's say we take a listen to that clip of Peter Schiff arguing with Art Laffer on Kudlow and Company. This is from August 28th, 2006.
Prices pulled back sharply, but despite the Dow hitting a three-month high, more and more analysts are cautioning that a recession could be just around the corner. Joining us now to debate the issue, recession or not, we're going to be joined by Art Laffer. He's Chief Investment Officer of Laffer Investments and former economic advisor to President Reagan. And Peter Schiff, he's President of Euro Pacific Capital. Gentlemen, thanks for being here. Peter, I want to start with you. Although there are more and more people saying that the U.S. economy will be in a recession next year, it is still a minority position. Why do you think that a recession is coming, and just how bad is it going to be?
I think it's going to be pretty bad, and whether it starts in 07 or 08, I think, is immaterial. And I also think it's going to last not just for quarters, but for years. See, the basic problem with the U.S. economy is we have too much consumption and borrowing and not enough production and savings. And what's going to happen is the American consumer is basically going to stop consuming and start rebuilding his savings, especially when he sees his home equity evaporate. And when you have the economy 70% consumption, you can't address those imbalances without a recession. You know, rather than the recession being resisted, it should really be embraced, because the disease is all this debt-financed consumption. Huh. The cure is that we stop consuming and start saving and producing again, and that's a recession. And sometimes, you know, medicine tastes bad, but you got to swallow it.
Art Laffer, you hear him? He says the consumer's going to slow down in order to rebuild the savings. And you know that two-thirds of the American economy is driven by the consumer. Do you believe that?
No, I don't believe any of it whatsoever, Michelle. Excuse me. But, you know, what he's saying is that savings is way down in this country, but wealth has risen dramatically. The United States economy has never been better shape. There is no tax increase coming in the next couple of years. Monetary policy is spectacular. We have freer trade than ever before. And not only that, but there are no incomes policies things here. I think Peter is just totally off base, and I don't think it's going to be... I mean, I just don't know where he's getting his stuff.
Well, one of us is off base, but it's definitely not me. I mean, it's not wealth that's increased in the last few years. We haven't increased our productive capacity. All that's increased is the paper values of our stocks and real estate. But that's not real wealth, no more than the NASDAQ was wealth. When you see the stock market come down and the real estate bubble burst, all that phony wealth is going to evaporate. And all that's going to be left is all the debt that we accumulated to foreigners.
Peter, I'm going to take a bet with you on this one. I'll bet you a penny on this one that if you'll sign a letter saying that if you're wrong, you'll sign a letter that you were wrong to me in this. But you're just way off base. There is nothing out there that tells us we're going to have a nice slowdown, but it's not going to be a crash.
All right, let me ask you this.
I'll
a lot
bet you
of
a lot
folks out there
penny.
Point to the housing market, and they say that a huge percentage of jobs created, some argue as much as 30% of the job creation over the last few years, has been because of the housing boom, whether it's construction, whether it's mortgage brokers, real estate brokers, et cetera. And if that all goes away, what happens
there
to
will
those
be
jobs?
Lots of, there will be lots of things to fill it back up again, Michelle.
Such as?
You know, the neat thing about this economy is we have a lot of flexibility in what we produce and what we have in the wealth. And housing has filled a huge gap coming here, and other things will fill in that gap. It's really not a housing economy. This is an economy that's driven by good economic policies, by good monetary policy, by good trade policy, and it's working beautifully. And unless
I guess,
you change those, it just
good
won't
if
happen.
You're... I suppose it's good if you're an investor in gold or oil or other foreign assets, but it's certainly not good from the point of view of the United States. And, you know, from the real estate, it's not just the wealth effect or the jobs that directly come from real estate, but because we've had such artificially low interest rates, which are quickly going to become a thing of the past,
Peter, the 10-year yield is still, you know, the Fed keeps going and going and going here. And
right, what I'm
and
talking about is,
thank you, Michelle,
a lot of people have adjustable rate mortgages that are going to reset over the next couple of years. And they're going to see, people are going to see their monthly mortgage payments go up by 50%, 100%. And a lot of that is going to take a lot of spending away from the economy, because people are going to be spending whatever money they have.
And what about the people who
payments.
Earn the interest, Peter?
It's
a zero-sum game. Every interest dollar paid is interest dollar earned.
The people that earn the dollars are in China and in Japan and in Europe. They're not in America anymore. We don't owe it to ourselves. We owe it abroad.
Oh, my goodness. I have never heard so many mistakes made in Syriatum in my life, Peter.
Well, then you ought to listen to your own clip.
Well, I do a lot. And, you know, what can I tell you, Peter? It's a bet of a penny in your honor on the stake, and mine too.
Peter, when you talk about selling to China, to India, et cetera, what is wrong with that? If we are selling products, if they're buying products around the world, that lifts the entire
economy. The problem is we're not selling them products. They are making products and sending them here.
We're outsourcing Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke to them. That's why they're holding those dollars. Well, it's not as a favor to us.
Well,
my
sure
goodness.
It is. Look, we're running up $60 billion a month trade deficit. That means that the world is providing us with $60 billion more of goods and services
that's
than we can
true,
afford
Peter.
To pay for.
Peter, that's not true. No, listen, Peter, for one second. They are holding deposits in the U.S. not as a favor to us because they like holding them there. We are outsourcing our monetary policy to China and to a lot of the rest of the world, and they're paying us huge amounts of seigniorage gain for the act of providing them with a banking system and monetary policy. It's called seigniorage gain. Gosh.
All we're providing them with is inflation, and they're accumulating assets while we're accumulating liabilities. We've got to service this debt. We've got to pay interest on this. We're not borrowing to produce.
We ran trade deficits from 1640 until 1870, 230 years
Art,
of trade deficits, and
Art,
we built our
missing,
country and foreign capital.
You're missing the most important aspect. Back then, we borrowed to build factories, to build infrastructure. We were borrowing to produce. Now we're borrowing to remodel our kitchens, to buy big screen TVs,
vacations. Peter, in all these years that we've been running these trade deficits, the wealth of the average American household has been going up.
The average American is going deeper and deeper into debt. He's struggling to get by. And all that happens is some appraiser tries to say that your house is worth all this money. This is an illusion.
Peter,
look at
hold
all those
on one second. Art, what measure are you using
I'm using the household survey from the Federal Reserve Board, which shows American household net wealth. You know, he's using a savings rate measure from the National Income and Profit Accounts, which is totally inappropriate for the purpose he's doing it.
Look,
and
Art,
I don't know how to respond
Art,
to it when he doesn't know the numbers.
Art, why do a husband and a wife both have to work to provide enough income to support a family?
Because they love the jobs at low tax rates.
Don't love these jobs.
Of course they do.
Most women with children aren't working because they love their job. They're working because they need the income. They can't afford it.
Oh, boy, now you're going into
it. With lower tax rates, it makes it much more valuable to work. Gee, and lower interest rates, you can buy more. It's great.
I don't know, Peter. Are you suggesting that most women would stay home?
I think a lot of women, especially, you know, I see women, you know, seven months pregnant sometimes when I'm out, you know, waiting tables. They don't want to be there. They need to be there because their husband doesn't make enough after he finished paying taxes to support the family. But what we need to do in America is get back to the business of saving again and producing again. We just can't keep accumulating debt. We just can't put this consumption on a national credit card and assume that just because a crisis hasn't happened yet, that it's never going to happen.
I don't know, Peter. I would argue that a lot of women like to work, putting aside the women who are 7, 8, 9 months pregnant. I think a lot of women enjoy their job and enjoy the privilege that men have had for a very long time, which is to get out of the house and be productive in many ways,
not just
raising children.
Gentlemen,
I barely participated. I enjoyed that.
How boring and how besides the point that is. Yeah, women's lib, this, that. Everybody loves their job, right? Nobody rolls out of bed in the morning going, oh, crap, I gotta go to work because I got to go to work. Oh, no, we're all just seeking fulfillment. That's why we show up and punch these clocks. Obviously, and he's obviously a sexist for saying that there's could possibly be economic reasons why across the country both parents are working when perhaps one or the other of them would prefer to be home with their children. What a pig for saying so. Well, that's funny. It's funny to hear the Chicago school guys get absolutely schooled. I think you could even say beaten down by the Austrian school. And if there's one thing that annoys me, it is when liberals and leftists mistakenly believe that the Chicago school monetarists and supply-siders are libertarians, that Milton Friedman was a libertarian. And I guess, you know, if you want to define that term as broadly as you possibly can, then the Chicago school is a libertarian school. But no, not really. Milton Friedman did oppose the draft quite effectively, too. And there were some very libertarian things about him. But boy, the guys who took his classes, ain't nothing libertarian about them. And boy, did Schiff make a fool out of that Laffer guy. I wonder if Laffer's come up with his one penny, which is worth what now? A thousandth of a penny or something? What the hell kind of reward is that for winning the bet? You heard, of course, Peter Schiff offering to up the ante a little bit, but... I think the host of the show interrupted before they could get to work on that. All right, stay tuned. Another pet peeve of mine is the cops and the way that they arrest and turn over to district attorneys across this country for prosecution people who are, in fact, completely innocent of the crimes they're convicted of and or accused of, and of course, the juries that come back with guilty verdicts for innocent men. And we're going to be talking with Jason Krieg from the Innocence Project, which I've always wondered about and never interviewed anybody from before. But looks like some interesting stuff to talk about going on in the news right now. And so I want to learn all about that. And if you like, you can listen in. It's Chaos Radio Austin, 92.7. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio, Chaos 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. Streaming live at chaosradioaustin.org and antiwar.com/radio. And our next guest today is Jason Krieg. He is a staff attorney at the Innocence Project, formerly with the Southern Center for Human Rights. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you.
That's good to have you here, and I got to tell you, I've always been interested in this Innocence Project thing, and all these years I've spent interviewing people on the radio, I've never gotten around to talking to any of you guys before, but you're in the news recently. I know the big story, I guess, in true crime this week is the death penalty case that got put off in Georgia, and we can talk about that, but I saw you guys in the news for getting another Dallas resident freed from prison after what I think was, decades for a crime that he did not commit. And I was wondering if you could, if we could start the show by you telling us about that story as much
sure,
as you can.
Sure. Last Friday, Johnny Lindsay, I think, became the 19th person exonerated in Dallas through DNA evidence. And Mr. Lindsay is represented by local attorneys, the local Innocence Project in Dallas, and Michelle Moore was his attorney. But his case is representative of many that have happened in Dallas and across the country. He spent 26 years in prison for a crime
sexual assault that happened in 1981 that he did not commit, and has conclusively been proven that he did not commit it through DNA evidence. And the reason, I guess if you have to give one reason why, you know, Mr. Lindsay had to spend that time there, is it was a faulty eyewitness identification that caused his conviction at the time, and we only now can prove that because we have DNA. We can go back and test the evidence and show that, you know, it wasn't Mr. Lindsay. So, you know, what happened in his case, there was a photo lineup. This is literally just, you know, photos that are shown to a victim. And in his case, about a year after the crime took place, the victim had moved away. The local police in Dallas sent her the copies of the photo lineup, and she picked out Mr. Lindsay. And, you know, this is just a remarkably uncommon way to do a lineup, and certainly doesn't follow any of the practices that we now know can help make identifications reliable. But she picked out Mr. Lindsay. He had what I think most people would think would be a pretty good alibi. He was at work, and he had time cards showing that he was at work, and his boss explaining that he was at work. But unfortunately, the jury didn't believe him. And, you know, what we now, you know is that we don't have to rely on those time cards or the identification. We could just point to the DNA and say, you know, he was conclusively not the person, and he spent 26 years in prison for a crime that he didn't commit.
Mm-hmm. Now, this man is a poor black guy, right, Johnny Lindsay? I'm curious as to whether he had a jury of his peers.
Well, you know, I don't know the composition of the jury in 1981, but I suspect that your concerns were evident. But I don't know what the racial composition or the economic composition of the jury was at the time.
You know, I don't know if it was the Chappelle Show. I think it was the Chappelle Show, a rerun that I saw recently, really kind of drove this home, where it was a rich white guy accused, and he looks over at the jury, and it's a bunch of hard-ass brothers, and very much not a group of his peers sitting in judgment of him. Roles reversed, and that really drives the point home, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens, though, in these cases, obviously a very tragic crime happened, and probably regardless of who was sitting in the jury box, you know, you obviously feel for the victim. She went through a terrible crime, and I'm sure she believed that she was picking out the right person at the time. You know, we just now know that she wasn't, and I don't think that, you know, in all of our cases that I know of where we have this issue come up, the victim truly believes, they're thinking they have the right person, and it's not surprising that the jury believe the victim. All of that makes sense. What we can focus on is that there are ways to minimize kind of an inaccurate identification. And one way that would have been very easy in Mr. Lindsay's case is not to do a photo lineup that was sent through the mail for the victim to look at, you know, by herself.
Well, what about the defense? And did they cross-examine the police and ask them in front of the jury about how this lineup was conducted?
I'm sure it was done in this case, and I'm sure that the victim's identification won out when she got in the courtroom and said, you know, that's him sitting right there.
Well,
and
this is
that's very, very powerful, and that's evidence that minimizes, you know, many other things that come in during a trial.
Well, and that's kind of a regular thing, isn't it, that people recognize the perpetrator from the photo. By the time they get in the courtroom, they're not really remembering the original crime. They're remembering the guy from the picture.
Certainly one possibility, and it certainly comes up. You know, we've been able to identify, though, in almost three-quarter of our cases of the DNA exonerations across the country, there's been an issue with an eyewitness misidentification. So clearly each of us do not have as good a memory as we think, and probably our memories, when you've just gone through a very traumatic experience, there's other things working against our memory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, aside from a police officer who's deliberately trying to suggest someone, even if you take that deliberate kind of cheating out of the system, there's a whole host of things that cause us to not be as accurate when we think we're identifying someone. But by the time you get to the trial and you point across the courtroom and say that's the person, you know, who committed this horrible crime, that's very, very powerful evidence. And no one would doubt that, you know, the victims in these cases believe that they're pointing to the right person, and juries believe that too. And now, fortunately, we can look at some of these cases and with DNA evidence, you know, just demonstrate conclusively, absolutely, 100%, that it wasn't, you know, the right person. And in about 40% of the cases, we can go on and identify who the actual perpetrator was.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, this is something interesting that I notice I watch, you know, not too often, but sometimes I watch, you know, Bill Curtis investigative reports and those kinds of true crime stories and American Justice, that kind of thing. And a lot of those things are about false convictions and people who eventually are released. And I've noticed that in some of these cases, the evidence of innocence is so overwhelming where you're just sitting in your own living room throwing up your hands and saying, my God, I can't believe they got a conviction on this poor guy, and thank goodness he's finally got some justice. But inevitably, there's an interview with the victim's family. In fact, I just saw this yesterday in the case of the guy in Atlanta where it was an off-duty cop that got killed, and so they had an interview with his buddy. And it seems like the closer to the victims the people are, the less willing they are to even consider for a moment that the original arrestee is possibly the wrong guy. And it doesn't matter how overwhelming the case is, it's too personally unsettling for them to think that the real guy got away, or especially that they helped put away an innocent man and in effect helped the real killer get away, that they just refuse to consider. And they would rather just see an innocent man sit in prison than admit to themselves that they've been wrong.
But I think you're hitting on part of the work that's very, very important, and I don't think that any of us can underestimate the kind of the initial trauma that a victim goes through, and then the having to relive it again when it comes back 26 years afterwards or 23 years afterwards in Thomas McGowan's another Dallas case, to have to relive it again. And I can understand that there's some of that reluctance, but that's certainly not representative of all the cases. There's another case in Texas right now where, unfortunately, the person who was convicted died in prison. His name's Tim Cole, and the victim in that case, you know, knows of the evidence, knows it's not him, and has been remarkable in reaching out to Mr. Cole's family and trying to clear his name, basically working with his defense attorneys trying to clear his name. And there are numerous examples of that where the victim is able to, you know, work through what clearly is a re-traumatization of very difficult times and accept the new facts and try to move on. Certainly that doesn't happen in every case, but I don't think, you know, we can't fault them because they're, you know, in every instance, regardless, they and their family have gone through a very, very, you know, troubling event at a minimum. So, you know, I think what's more disturbing to me is when a prosecutor or a police officer who investigated the case kind of stonewalls and in light of DNA evidence that's conclusive, just refuses to believe it. That's much more troubling to me than when a victim or a victim's family member who's working through, you know, very difficult things, than when they have trouble believing the scientific evidence.
Right, and it seems like that happens a lot, too. That's a pretty regular thing where the prosecutors refuse to budge. I remember in this recent Dallas case, the judge specifically praised this prosecutor for his willingness to not stonewall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we
the
see
exception
that now.
That
Dallas
the rule.
Dallas is somewhat unique across the country right now because they have a prosecutor's office, a district attorney's office, who's willing to be open-minded and look at these old convictions and really seek the truth. And fortunately, one of the other reasons why Dallas is unique is even before the current prosecutor, for really basically back until the early 80s, they've had a great system of collecting and preserving evidence, which we don't see across the country, and it's not always that way. So in Dallas, we kind of have a prosecutor's office who's open, and we have the ability to test evidence because it was saved and preserved. If you don't have both those things, it can be very, very difficult to prove your innocence, even if the crime is just based on biological evidence.
Mm-hmm. And now that's a very important point about proving innocence, because once you've been convicted, the burden of proof is on you, not beyond a reasonable doubt, but at least almost, I guess, correct me where I'm wrong here, I'm not a lawyer, but something along the lines of the kind of preponderance of evidence that you would need in a civil case or something in order to win your appeal.
Well, it's more than a civil case, but it's certainly the burden does shift. The presumption of innocence ends when you're convicted, and that presumption is gone forever. And in order to vacate your conviction, to prove your innocence, the statutes vary from state to state, but in general, it's definitely a tougher burden than, you know, pre-trial when you already have the presumption of innocence.
Mm-hmm. And now, you know, this is an anecdote, and I can't prove that what she says is right or anything like that, but I believed her at the time. It made perfect sense. She was an assistant district attorney from Harris County, Houston, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, she was completely innocent of this. And I guess I was probably pretty hard on her asking all the questions I was asking. Of course, she never did this. But the way that she perceived the rest of the district attorney's office operating in Houston is take whoever the cops brought in and prosecute them to the nth degree. And if they're really innocent, they'll get out on appeal. And that the prosecutors, that's simply their modus operandi. They really don't care one way or another whether these people are guilty or innocent. They just need to get their conviction rating up, et cetera.
I mean, look, there's a couple things here. Certainly that's not what prosecutors' associations, either state or national associations, that's not what they will say. And if you read any of their literature, they would say, you know, we're here to do justice, and we have as much of an interest in not convicting innocent people as we have in convicting guilty people. And that's, of course, the goal that they should have. And I think that this anecdote, of course, there are individual assistant district attorneys who, you know, get overcome by the competitive nature of it, want to get a promotion, whatever it may be. They're people just like, you know, everyone else, and they may just be overly aggressive. And you know, that obviously contributes to wrongful convictions. A prosecutor who's essentially trying to game the system or cheat a little bit to get an unfair advantage to get a conviction. And we see this in some of our cases. Sometimes it's overt, whereas exculpatory evidence was excluded from the defense at trial. And, you know, the prosecutor has a clear duty to disclose to a defendant pre-trial or at trial any evidence that's favorable to the defendant and in the possession of the prosecutor or the state. That includes the police officers and other investigative agencies. Sometimes we see the prosecutors just don't follow the law. And they can benefit from that, obviously, by getting an easier conviction. And in our cases, we see that happen. There was another recent Dallas exoneration, Stephen Phillips, and his case is currently been exonerated by the trial court in Dallas, and the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to make the official order vacating all of his sentences. But in that case, there was some exculpatory evidence that just wasn't turned over. Maybe if it was, you know, Mr. Phillips wouldn't have spent 25 years in prison.
Well, you know, I think, you know, for argument's sake, when we're talking in abstractions like this, obviously, you know, every judge is a different individual and so forth. Every prosecutor is different. But it seems like, okay, so for argument's sake, we have to give them the benefit of the doubt that these are professional people, that they're doing as good a job of as they can of, you know, doing the prosecuting and trying to get it right. It seems like there must be something wrong with the incentive structure, the way it's built, in terms of their incentive to get it right in the first place, and then accountability for when they get it wrong. I mean, you can have, in some places, like in Dallas County, where you have the sheetrock scandal, where people are just going to prison by the score for possessing sheetrock that the police called cocaine, that kind of thing. No cop, no DA, no anybody ever went to jail for what they did to all those innocent people.
Yeah, I think that, you know, going to jail, you know, criminal liability is probably not going to happen, but there may be other reforms that can change things, and it may just be something as simple as a district attorney, you know, who, or assistant district attorney, who's found to have withheld Brady evidence, for example, which is the favorable evidence that a defendant should get, you know, maybe he or she, you know, has a mandatory, you know, 3-month-long probationary period where a supervisor then is going to have to do every case with him or something like that. And it doesn't have to be, you know, take their bar license away immediately and don't let them have a job. There are very simple solutions that I think could curb some of this. And I think there are some jurisdictions and some district attorneys who are open to that and willing to do that. But that definitely would be a change from kind of how things are run now, on average.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's funny. I was just thinking that I guess because of their monopoly, that if you add accountability for when they get it wrong, ultimately the result of that is going to be they're going to make it more difficult to prove that they were wrong.
Well, maybe that's the case. I don't know. And I think that, you know, the kind of increasing rate of these DNA exonerations, which are just crystal clear when you have them because the evidence, you know, can't be questioned. You identify the actual perpetrator. You exclude the person who was convicted and did many years in prison. You know, at some point, even the most kind of stonewalled prosecutor has to look at the numbers and you know, be moved by them and at least be willing and open to admit that, well, there can be mistakes and there are mistakes in cases, and there's no reason to think that my jurisdiction is the only place in the country that wouldn't have ever made a mistake. You know, eventually I think, maybe I'm too optimistic, but I think that that would happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, it isn't perfect by a long shot, but I think the basic premises of the American criminal justice system, well, maybe not anymore, but used to be, as far as I can tell, and certainly ought to be, you know, the standard for the world to look to and copy. I mean, our Bill of Rights is really cool about they can't force you to testify against yourself. You are mandated to have defense counsel to help you defend yourself. You're mandated to be able to cross-examine all the witnesses against you and all the evidence against you and all these appeals processes, the presumption of innocence and a jury of your peers in serious cases, this kind of thing. This ought to work pretty good, it sounds like, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're showing. You know, despite all of those protections for someone who, you know, faces criminal allegations, there are mistakes made. And some of the reason why the mistakes made are just innocent. They're always going to happen. And sometimes mm-hmm. it's because people are trying to kind of cheat the system a little bit. And then sometimes it's made because, you know, some of the crimes, especially the crimes where we can deal with biological evidence, they're, you know, vicious, traumatic crimes. And there's a lot of pressure on a prosecutor to solve them. You know, they go unsolved for months. You know, people are nervous, and they should be. And there's a lot of pressure on everyone, the police at that point, to solve them. And, you know, sometimes that pressure probably makes police officers or prosecutors miss certain things that they would have caught if it wasn't as high pressure of a situation. And each of those things, I think, is a good reason to just be open. And we would argue that district attorney's offices across the country should be open and willing to consent to post-conviction DNA testing. You know, no one wins if the wrong person is in prison.
Right, yeah, no doubt about that. And is that mandatory in how many states?
No, most states now, I think about 42 states, do have some kind of state statute providing for post-conviction DNA testing. That is, someone who's in prison or was convicted can request DNA testing according to a state statute. There's still a handful of states that don't have that yet. But the way the statute is interpreted varies dramatically from state to state and local jurisdiction to local jurisdiction.
Right.
Because, you know, it makes a huge difference whether the prosecutor, the local prosecutor, is going to be willing and open to examining a new case or whether he or she is going to read the record and say, look, there's so much evidence of guilt here, we don't even need to do the testing. And those are the cases where we think, you know, that's the exact opposite attitude that one should have, because we've seen exonerations that, you know, the case looked like it was open and shut, looked like they had the right person from the beginning, and there was a lot of evidence. Turns out, you know, just not the right guy.
That's funny. You know, there's this circular argument that says, well, Jason, you're just proving that the system works.
Yep.
Way to go.
No, that's true. That's true. And we face that sometimes. You know, it's just, there's just a huge variation in the kind of responses that we get from district attorneys. But hopefully, you know, hopefully more places will be like Dallas, and I think that will be the case. And then as a result of some of these things, we'll change the way, you know, eyewitness identifications are done. We'll change the way interrogations are done. In a quarter of our cases, the defendant gave an incriminating statement, either a confession or some other incriminating statement, to a crime that he or she didn't commit. And, you know, if we tape recorded or videotaped all police interrogations, maybe we would figure out, you know, why that person ended up giving an incriminating statement to a crime that he or she, you know, didn't commit.
Yeah.
So there are reforms that we try and argue for based on the exonerations, the DNA exonerations that we see across the country.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm reminded, remember that movie My Cousin Vinny, where Ralph Macchio says to the cop, I killed him.
I actually haven't seen that movie, but...
And then the transcript says, and then he said to me, I killed him, as the cop's reading it in court.
Right, yeah. You know, I mean, once you're reading that cold transcript, it can come off certainly very differently than, you know, what you would see if you were able to listen to it or watch it.
Yeah. Now, about those confessions, the false confessions, I don't want to be too specific and accidentally say coerced confessions, because I know that there are people who... probably really not understanding how the legal system works in terms of, well, they got me now, but the trials later and these kinds of things, are put in a position where they just want to get out of this tiny room with the hot lights and these two brutes with the bad breath, and so they confess to anything. But on the other hand, I remember learning this, I guess, back in psychology class at community college. There are false confessions to serious crimes all the time, and even in situations where the cop could very credibly say, I swear I did not pressure the guy at all. I didn't put words in his mouth at all. He straight confessed. Turns out it was someone else.
What is going on there? It happens both ways. Everything from the overt kind of pressure, a coerced confession, down to, you know, a police officer can, according to the U.S. Constitution, can lie to a suspect during the interrogation and say, you know, we have your fingerprint there. Why don't you just tell us what it is? You know, even though no fingerprints were collected, that's okay. That's not seen as a violation to the law. Yeah, and then they're all the way down to, you know, for whatever reason, someone confesses to a crime that, you know, is just voluntarily confesses to a crime that he or she didn't do. Those are not really the cases that we deal with that often. That just hasn't been the spectrum of our cases that involved incriminating statements. Usually they're statements given after hours of interrogation. Almost always they're statements given without the help of an attorney, without being able to consult an attorney beforehand. And at times they're statements that were based on what are legal police investigative tactics, like lying to a suspect about what the evidence is that they've already collected.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, you know, now we can go back and see, you know, regardless of what happened, we can go back and see, okay, well, what was the true answer? And, you know, what does DNA show us? And then we can, you know, if we were able to videotape the statement, you know, maybe you would see that what a police officer later testified to as, you know, sometimes it happens where the defendant says something and then the police officer says only the suspect could have known that. You know, that's a piece of information that only the perpetrator could have known. Therefore, it must be him. And, you know, if we could watch the videotape, I bet you we would see sometimes that maybe inadvertently, maybe intentionally, some information is kind of leaked to the person who's being interrogated, and then, you know, and then he states that a bit of information is turned around and says, you know, only the perpetrator could know that.
And, mm-hmm.
You know, that's another thing that would be minimized if we were just simply able to record interrogations. And right now, I mean, I think more and more jurisdictions are doing it. There's over 350 local jurisdictions who record interrogations for certain types of crimes. And so, you know, I think it would be great if all of them were.
Yeah, that seems like it's good for all sides, right? If the cops are only doing their job as best they can, then no problem.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be. I mean, it can be pretty simple. It can be, you know, when you get in the room, the tape starts automatically, and, you know, you don't have to fumble around with press and record, and, you know, we can do things digitally now that we couldn't do 15 years ago or even 10 years ago.
Right.
That would seem to make it pretty easy.
Right, hey, that's how they turn on their dashboard cameras. Here's when they turn on their lights and siren. The dashboard camera kicks in.
It comes on automatically, yeah. I mean, it could be the same way in an interview room. There's no reason why that couldn't be the case.
Yeah, sometimes the tape is destroyed or happened to be off at the time that there's a fatal shooting in the back of somebody. But this is Austin, Texas, so you know, all civilians got to walk around in bulletproof vests so the APD doesn't take our lives away from us.
You're not giving too much of a good, I guess, critique of Austin. I'm going to have to be careful next time I'm there.
Yeah, well, you know, I really need to look into the numbers, you know, proportion-wise. But I know that I was trying to keep track as best I could and reading the local paper a lot more back in the early part of this century. And I remember, well, it still is sort of, but, you know, relatively speaking, the early part of this century, 2000, 2001, 2002, and it just seemed like nothing but shooting after shooting after shooting of unarmed black men, and it was incredible almost. Like, one of them was a retarded guy who they said was the equivalent of a three-year-old in intelligence, was running down the street in his underwear screaming because the fire engine had driven by and the siren had spooked him.
Good.
And so here the cop could have just taken him down with a stiff arm or a headlock or grab him or whatever. Instead, he shot him 9 times in the chest because the guy picked up a stick that then magically turn into a branch, which magically turn into a threat to the life of this officer, which is ridiculous. And they get away with these kinds of things. You know, when we turn the scales around and who's killing who, if a Texan kills a cop, he gets the death penalty. Forget about it. If a cop kills a Texan, he's a hero. Maybe he gets a week off with pay, and then everything's fine.
Yeah, that's tragic, certainly. That's definitely tragic.
Well, and it cuts right to the heart of the entire theory that we have a rule of law, which even applies to the president and the district attorney, too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in our work, we're just repeatedly advocating, though, for district attorneys being open and willing to review past cases and old cases. And when you are, you find out just what's happening in Dallas, that there are a bunch of people who are convicted and spend time in prison for crimes that they never committed. And Dallas, there's no reason to expect that the numbers would be any different in any other city if we had a DA who was open to reviewing them, and if we had a lab that or a evidence storage facility that collected and preserved evidence, you know, over the last several decades.
Well, now that's a really important point, that Dallas County, the district attorney there now, he just happens to be so willing to come forward with this evidence that that's why it seems like there's so many innocent people convicted in Dallas. But you're saying there's really no reason to believe that Dallas is particularly worse. It's just that they have a better district attorney telling the truth now.
I mean, I think that's the case. Of course, we will probably never know the true answer to that, but because there are other factors, obviously, that could play into this. But I certainly wouldn't think that if the evidence was available everywhere, and if we had district attorneys everywhere who were willing to search for the truth and look for the evidence and consent to testing, that Dallas wouldn't be, you know, drastically different from other big cities.
You know, I read a statistic recently that said that this country of 300 million people out of, 6.2 or 3 or 4 billion on Earth has 25% of the planet's prisoners. Is that really right? Do you know about that?
I don't know if that number is accurate, but we definitely have a disproportionate number of people who are incarcerated in some form.
It's over 2 million, right?
Sorry?
It's over 2 million people.
Yeah, and I think that number, though, includes people who are involved in far as probation, local jails, and prisons.
Oh, I thought it was 7 billion7 million when you take parole and probation. That it was 2 million actually in cages.
We could check this easily, I'm sure. I suppose.
Right.
I don't know.
The magic of Google. I bet you someone in the chat room could find the link for us. And
that's probably true.
Get it straight. I'm sorry, I was bringing up numbers off the top of my head and not knowing what the hell I'm talking about. And by the way, you know that anecdote earlier about the Houston assistant district attorney?
Mm-hmm.
I'm remembering now that the context of that was this was when the scandal was in all the papers about the crime lab in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And how I think they even had quotes of the so-called scientists at the crime lab saying their job was to help police get convictions, and if that meant lying about anything that was supposed to be considered science, that was no problem to them.
Yeah, well, you know, this is not, unfortunately, this is not as uncommon as we would hope to be. And if you just look at the DNA exonerations across the country, if you just look at those as your universe, because they're the easiest ones for us, we know the person absolutely certainly didn't do it, 65% of the wrongful convictions involve some kind of lab error or some kind of junk science. And again, here sometimes it's science that's literally not science, that's made up, or a lab analyst who really isn't a scientist, or a lab analyst who really didn't do the testing that he said he was going to do. And then sometimes it's just error, innocent or non-intentional error. But 65% of the cases that we find from these wrongful convictions, there's lab error or junk science involved.
Yeah, I remember on American Justice or whatever on A&E, or even on all the news, they always used to talk about the FBI crime lab as the gold standard of the most advanced scientists in the whole world. And then Frederick Whitehurst came out and said the FBI crime lab is an absolute disaster. If this is your gold standard, we are in deep, deep trouble.
Yeah, and you know, right now, fortunately, we don't have to rely on some of the tests that, for example, the FBI used. One of the most recent forensic techniques that has come under a huge microscope is called comparative bullet lead analysis, and have been used, I think, for about 30 or 40 years. And finally, the FBI just admitted, you know, this, there isn't a scientific basis for this comparison, and it was a way to try and to compare a bullet collected from a crime scene, the lead content of that bullet, to other bullets from the, the package of bullets that the bullet from the crime scene came from. And finally, the FBI just admitted, you know, this just isn't scientific. There's no backing for this. And now those cases are being reviewed, and they're open to it now, certainly, to review those convictions that were based on comparative bullet lead analysis. And that's an area that here at the Innocence Project we've aided in that review, but primarily and really exclusively we deal with cases that involve biological evidence, mm-hmm. And DNA evidence.
Wow. Do you have any idea the numbers of people convicted with bullet lead analysis testimony included?
Unfortunately, I don't know the numbers. And, you know, it would be, there'd be two different numbers, right? There would be a huge number where that was part of the prosecution's case, one part of the evidence.
Right.
And then there would be a smaller number where that would have been the kind of linking forensic evidence, and it would have been based, the conviction would have been based on that and then other circumstantial evidence. It's really those latter cases that are the ones to focus on, not the cases where there was other concrete, non-circumstantial evidence and where the bullet lead analysis was just a part of the state's case. At least if you're going to focus on any, you'd focus on the ones where it was a big part of the case first.
Right. Wow. So now this Atlanta case... this guy is being sprung because the witnesses are changing their story, not because of biological evidence, right?
Right. Troy Davis's case does not have biological evidence in it, and he's not actually being sprung. He right now has a stay from the U.S. Supreme Court because of the...
Relatively sprung.
Yeah. Well, of the witnesses who testified against him at trial, of the nine witnesses, seven of them now have recanted their testimony and said, you know, what I told the jury back then, what this conviction was based on, just isn't accurate. And unfortunately, Mr. Davis hasn't been able to have a full hearing to present that evidence in any court. And right now, the U.S. Supreme Court is evaluating whether or not they should stay his execution indefinitely to allow Mr. Davis to present the evidence from the seven witnesses who recanted. And it's a very extremely troubling case. There's, needless to say, there's huge amounts of evidence that contradicts information that contradicts the evidence that was presented at trial that, could establish his innocence. And why courts have refused to allow him to present that so far is mystifying to me and extremely troubling. If we're going to use the ultimate penalty, I think we should take as much care as we could.
Mm. Well, and, you know, I guess as a younger man, I used to support the death penalty because, of course, I asked the universal question, what if somebody did that to somebody you love? You would want them to get the death penalty, open and shut, simple as that. And yet, what we're really dealing with here is the state and 12 yahoos deciding whether somebody really did something or not and whether they deserve death or not. And are any of us really perfect enough to have taking somebody's life as a punishment when we have a government that can't deliver the mail or do any other thing right? They certainly, as you guys are showing every day, convict innocent people. I guess, have you guys broken down the numbers, how many innocent people are sent to prison every day in this country?
I don't think anyone could answer that number, but what we have been able to show looking back of the roughly first 220 or so DNA exonerations, 16 of those people spent time on death row. So, you know, those were people who the system, we all thought that we had the worst of the worst, sent them to death row. And you know, of the first 220 or so, 16 of those individuals turned out to be the wrong guy, and that should give us all pause.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a battle here. The most famous case in Austin since the shooting from the tower is the yogurt shop murders, and there's something new about DNA that I guess the defense is saying that they believe they can prove that DNA collected at the crime scene under, I guess, new science, is that it, would be able to conclusively prove that their clients were not the perpetrators of that. Do you know about that?
I only know about that case in the most general sense, but what I could add is that there are new methods of collecting DNA and analyzing it that allow us to get a profile off of smaller and smaller amounts of biological evidence and evidence that is decades old or maybe a little degraded. And the science certainly has allowed for that in recent years. Just since, 2004, we've developed a couple new tests. Well, we haven't, but we've been able to benefit from a couple new types of DNA tests that allow us to get profiles from very small amounts of biology. So I suspect that that's what's, one of the things that's happening there. Maybe there was testing before using a method that was available, at trial or years ago that seemed inconclusive, and there are testing methods that are available now that can provide us results that we couldn't get even just 4 years ago.
Well, I got to tell you, as I said at the beginning of the show, I don't know really why I haven't gotten around to interviewing any of you guys before, but I've been silently cheering y'all on since, I guess, the mid-90s or so was probably around the time I first heard of this thing, and it's such important work. Somebody's got to do it. I guess there weren't as many doing it before this, but now, and you guys put graduate students to work all across the country helping you and that kind of thing too, right?
Yeah, we have law students here at our clinic in Manhattan, law students from Cardozo School of Law, and then there are about 40 Innocence Project. There's an Innocence Network now, about 40, I think, maybe just over 40 organizations across the country, and many of them are affiliated with local law schools. Some of them are affiliated with journalism schools, and there's certainly a host of people working on this issue, not just to find the innocent people who are serving time, but also to try and ensure that reforms are taken to help the problem end.
All right, everybody, that's Jason Craig. He's from the Innocence Project. Oh, and by the way, a friend sent me a link here in the chat room to the New York Times article, Inmate Count in U.S. Dwarfs Other Nations, and they do say that we have 25% of the world's prisoners, 2.3 million criminals behind bars.
Wow.
All right, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate your time on the show and what you guys are all doing. So pass on my thanks to the rest, please, too.
Great, thanks so much.
All right, everybody, that's Anti-War Radio for today. We didn't really talk about the war much, did we? I guess at the beginning. Okay, we'll be back here tomorrow, 11 to 1 Texas time. Tomorrow we have scheduled an interview with Lou Rockwell, the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, about the history of money, banking, and war in this country. And then Frieda Berrigan from Mother Jones will be here to talk about America's empire of bases around the world. Thanks very much for listening. This one goes out to the APD.